Good morning, and welcome to week two of Israel's Chief Rabbis, our current mini-series. I will note that starting November 14th, in a few weeks, the next series will be Jewish Bioethics. From birth to death, I think we'll be talking, not sure what I had on there, but there's a flyer and I'll email it out. So the flyer will tell us what's there. So that'll be a 4-week series. Yes, that will be me.
Okay.
And it'll be here Wednesday mornings, 10 a.m. and so on. All right. So last week we started talking about Rabbi Ovadia Yosef, and one of the points that I wanted to make, and I think I might have made a little too strongly, was the setting into which he enters, the Israel of his day, in which there's terrible racism from the Ashkenazim toward the Sephardim. I am reminded, please make sure to turn off your phones or silence them or do something with them. Thank you. Okay. We talked about the institutional issues, such as the Chalukah, the distribution of money coming from Europe in the early days. And we talked about how the leading Zionists of that period at the end of the 19th century, beginning of the 20th century, were Ashkenazi. And we talked as well about, from a religious perspective, how there were movements, which we're going to discuss more today, to unify observant Jewry in Israel under the banner of Ashkenazi practice. I wanted to show basically the world of the Sephardim into which Rabbi Ovadia Yosef enters and in which he functions. But I felt afterwards that I probably went too far. I didn't want to condemn all Ashkenazim. That wasn't the goal. It wasn't a, so to speak, species-wide racism in which Ashkenazim are anti-Sephardim, and I want to make sure to clarify that. It was more of an initiative by people who were in power, who felt that from a secular perspective, the Sephardi Jews, the Mizrahi Jews, lacked the culture that Ashkenazi Jews had to be accepted in society, and that's something you see well beyond the Jewish community, this bias of one culture against another, as well as a sense religiously that Ashkenazi practice should be accepted in the name of unity. So what you had was a move by people who were in power and in authority. It existed among rank and file, but I don't want to convey the sense that it was somehow universal. That's number one. Number two, thanks to Diane and a question that she asked me later in the week, I learned something which I was going to put on the sheet, but actually, I did not put it on the sheet. But it's something to know about. She asked me whether there was any influence on what happened among the Sephardim in Israel in the 50s, 60s, 70s, whether there was any influence from the Black Power movement in the U.S. And my first reaction was, well, how could there be? And then my second reaction was Google. And lo and behold, there actually was a movement called the Israeli Black Panther Movement among the Sephardim. And it absolutely took inspiration from what was going on in the United States. So this is something that's worth knowing about. Sorry, yes. That's all right. Time cures that. So in any case, also something definitely worth knowing about, if you search online for Israeli Black Panthers, you will find loads of information, some of which is true. We talked about the world in which Rabbi Ovadia functioned, and then we gave a little bit of a biography. We talked about his early years. We talked about his family, how he comes. His family runs a shop. They're not wealthy. They're not from rabbinic royalty or anything like that. But he is so remarkably gifted in terms of his scholarship, in terms of his memory, in terms of his commitment to study. And he's also a man of the people. He tells jokes. He tells stories in his speeches. And he's clearly, I want to make sure that I'm clear here. It's not a as though you would think of him as a politician in that sense of it. It's not as though you would go to a lecture and spend the entire time hearing stories and jokes. He was very serious about halacha, about Jewish law, and that was clearly his emphasis. And he rises through the ranks as a judge, as a rabbi. In 1968, we said he was chief rabbi of Tel Aviv, and in 1972, what we concluded with was he is pushed to run for the chief rabbinate, and what you end up with is a mixed result in that election. Remember that the previous set of chief rabbis on the Ashkenazi side was Rabbi Unterman. On the Sephardi side was Rabbi Nissim. Rabbi Nissim and Rabbi Unterman are not getting along. Rabbi Unterman is going to be challenged by Rabbi Gorin. Especially because of that discussion we had about the Langer affair. Rabbi Gorin is the up-and-coming name. The more conservative establishment is not a fan of Rabbi Gorin, and they push Rabbi Unterman to run again. Rabbi Unterman says, well, I'm not going through another term beside Rabbi Nissim, so I'm only going to run if Rabbi Ovadia Yosef runs. And so you end up with Rabbi Ovadia Yosef being pushed to run, and really sounds like he's not so interested at this stage in his career. He's very comfortable in Tel Aviv, but he runs against Rabbi Nissim, and lo and behold, Rabbi Gorin and Rabbi Ovadia Yosef are the ones who win. So that's a problem. They are both incredibly strong personalities. Those who were here when we discussed Rabbi Gorin, both in the class on the Langer affair, and then I think also when we did in the June course, when we did chief rabbis, I think Rabbi Ziering may have spoken about Rabbi Gorin as well. So Rabbi Gorin is an extremely strong personality. He's the one who, to tell some of the stories, goes up Mount Sinai because of a dream somebody had, goes up what is supposed to be Mount Sinai on his own, like with a driver in the middle of the Sinai at a time when it's not safe to do that. And he brings a shofar because in this dream, he's supposed to blow a shofar. And he starts writing a Torah up there. Very much replaying Moses on Mount Sinai. He's the one who goes to the Kotel in 67 when they first liberate it and blows the shofar and leads Hallel and so on. Very, very strong figure. And he takes a stand against the establishment on the Langer affair, which we're not going to reopen right now, but it's a complicated question of legitimacy of two children and their ability to get married. And Rabbi Gorin takes a stand against most of the establishment, saying that it's permissible for them to get married. Rabbi Ovadia Yosef does not agree with him on this and on other issues, and he doesn't like the sense that Rabbi Gorin has made this decision about the Langers on a political basis, which is a sense that everybody had, that this had been a political decision, that it was not something, it was not a pure decision of Jewish law. If you take a look at source number one, this is from a book, Maran Harav Ovadia, by Rabbi Yehuda Haimowitz, a biography of Rabbi Ovadia Yosef. He tells the story of after the election for the chief rabbinate and a reception held in honor of Rabbi Ovadia. At a reception for Rav Ovadia at the home of Israel's president, attended by the cabinet and the leaders of the military, President Zalman Shazar and Prime Minister Golda Meir both urged the new Rishon LeZion, that's the title for the Sephardic chief rabbi, to find some way for the Langer children to marry. Defense Minister Moshe Dayan was particularly open about the government's expectations, declaring, I don't care how you find a heter. Heter is a... what? A heter is permission, like the word mutar, to be permitted. It says, I don't care how you find a heter, the bottom line is that we have to rule leniently for those who were prevented from marrying. By the time Harav Ovadia rose to address the crowd, the atmosphere in the room had grown tense, and it seemed at first that he would capitulate and guarantee to provide the solution they sought. And mind you, he's known for leniency. We talked about last week how he succeeded in finding ways for 1,000 women whose husbands were lost in the Yom Kippur War to all be able to remarry. So it's not that it's a foreign idea to him. Well, his opening words were, I am from a line of Rishon LeZions dating back more than 300 years, he began, all of whom worked with Kocha Dehetera to try to solve halachic issues that arose. Koach Dehetera is a term used in the Talmud, and what it means is the following. If you have a debate between two sages on any issue in which one rules that something is permitted and one rules that something is permitted, you have to respect the position of the permitting one. One says it's prohibited, one says it's permitted. You have to respect the position of the permitting one, because it's a lot harder to permit than to prohibit. Meaning it's really easy to say, well, I'm not really sure, so don't do it. Right? That's what people do in life in general. It's not a matter of religion, you know? I'm not sure what to do, so I'll stay on the safe side. It's harder to stand up and say, especially when there's a dispute, I actually think this is okay. And if someone is willing to go that distance and say it's okay, they must really have something to base themselves on, and therefore you respect the position. That's called koach dehetera, or kocha dehetera. Koach meaning strength. Heter again, permission. The strength to permit. So he says, the Rishon LeZion, the Sephardic chief rabbis, and he says going back more than 300 years, to, again, because in the Ottoman Empire you have this position of the Chacham Bashi, which becomes the Sephardic chief rabbi. He says, we've been doing this for centuries. And all of them use this principle that you respect the lenient position to try to solve halachic issues that arose. But before anyone could misinterpret his words, Harav Avadya declared, however, halacha is not determined at Dizengoff Square. It is determined in the Beit Midrash and by the Shulchan Aruch, the code of Jewish law. If there is any way to be lenient and permit something, the Sephardic Chachamim will be the first ones to rule leniently. But if there is no way to permit something, and after all the probing, investigating, and halachic examination that we do, we still cannot find a basis to allow it, we cannot permit something that is prohibited, heaven forbid. He says, don't push me, is his statement. And people would learn over the decades, you don't push Rabbi Yosef. You don't push Rabbi Goren either, which is the problem, because they're supposed to be working together. Look at what happens. On November 15th, exactly 1 month after their election, Harav Ovadia felt he had no choice but to report to the press that his Ashkenazi counterpart had issued an ultimatum 4 days earlier. If Harav Ovadia would not join him on a new three-man Beit Din, a new court, to hear the Langer case, Chief Rabbi Goren would cut off all contact with him and refuse to participate in a joint inaugural ceremony. Chief Rabbi Goren denied issuing the ultimatum, but Harav Avadya Yosef repeated the charge in an interview published in the Jerusalem Post, and sure enough, there was no joint inaugural ceremony. They had separate inaugural ceremonies. The issue here was a matter of Jewish law, not Ashkenazim and Sephardim. But you can see the subtext. Look how he emphasized in presenting his position. You should know if there's a way to be lenient and permit something, they Sephardic Chachamim. Right, the Chacham, the sage. The Chacham is an official title among the Sephardim. We're going to be the first ones to rule lenient, to rule leniently. So that sets them up, obviously, for a very difficult tenure together. And in 1977, a new law is enacted limiting the service of a chief rabbi to 10 years. Previously, it had been 5 years, but you could run for re-election. Now they said it's, you get 10 years and it's done. Ensuring that Rav Avadya will be done in 1982, Rabbi Goren will be done in 1982, and sure enough, they step down at that point. Rabbi Mordechai Eliyahu becomes the next chief rabbi, and I want to get a chance to talk about him a little bit also this morning. So we're going to try to get both of them in. Yeah.
Did he ever rule on the...
He prohibited, Rabbi Goren permitted, and they got married on the basis of Rabbi Goren's permission. Yeah. They were Ashkenazim. They got married based on his ruling. There was a whole story behind that. We talked about it last year. We had that session on it last year. Yeah. Okay. So, lest one think that by retiring Rabbi Yosef from the chief rabbinate in 1982, they succeed in ending his public career, you got to be kidding. He had 31 years to go after that, and he used them. He retained a public role, very much so. He went on to continue wearing his regalia. Those who read the email, the follow-up email that I sent out last week, noted there, I sent out a link to where you could find pictures of him, and you can see him. He kept that outfit after he was done being the chief rabbi, but more important than the clothing, in 1984, he created a political party called Shas, and we talked about that a little bit last week, their goal being to guard Sephardic tradition and promote Sephardic Jewry. Their slogan was, as I put on the sheet in source number 2 in transliteration, "Lahazir Atara Liyoshna," which means to restore the crown to its ancient glory. Atara is a crown, lahazir to restore, to return, and yoshna from yashan, old, to bring back the days of old. And the question, of course, is, well, what does that mean? What is it that you're trying to bring back to the days of old? And the answer really is the Sephardic community. That was his banner for Sephardim personally, and that was what he applied to this political party. What did Shas stand for politically? What was Shas looking for?
Was it very conservative to the right?
No. Mm-hmm. Nope. What did they want?
Equality for the
Sephardic community, and in what ways for them to become equal? You're right. But what was equality in terms of
education,
autonomy, political power? Major point: funding for education. Not only for Sephardic schools, there were Ashkenazi schools that benefited from this network also. But primarily it was about the Sephardic schools and about Sephardic culture and about Sephardic halakha, Sephardic law, meaning that the Rabbi Ovadia observed that in the early years and decades of the state, you found that Sephardic children would end up in schools, religious schools, where they would be told to follow Ashkenazi practice. They were told to follow whatever the Ashkenazi rabbis declared. He wanted to make sure that Sephardic kids would be raised with Sephardic culture and a Sephardic understanding of Jewish law. And it's fascinating because the hierarchy, in terms of the classic yeshivot, institutions of Torah study in Israel, was really Ashkenazi. Rabbi Menachem Shach was really the leader in the 80s of the what would be called the Lithuanian community. It means the Ashkenazi yeshiva oriented community, and he was the original leader of the Council of Torah Sages convened by Shas. But then they had a falling out over a very important political issue, which we're going to have to talk about. And at that point, Rabbi Yosef basically removed him. And took over instead as the head of this council. But they were very, it was very important to them to promote education, particularly for Sephardim, to promote Sephardic culture and heritage, to promote also social services. And this was something that they really succeeded with and managed to connect with people who had no interest whatsoever in Jewish law at all. Meaning, the people who worked for the Shas party followed the model that Rabbi Ovadia himself had. Rabbi Ovadia Yosef prided himself on being accessible. You could go pray at his minyan in his house, in his yeshiva. You could go meet him. You could go talk to him. And it was no problem. That was, it was an open door policy. That was the way that the leaders of Shas took it. They wanted to be accessible for everybody and to provide social services. So people who were indigent, who needed help getting a job, people who needed help with their homes, people who needed help economically, whatever it was, they could turn to Shas for support. Which is why Shas had a very broad base of support throughout Israel. Because people knew you could actually rely on them. These are people you elected for office, and they actually followed through. And that was a large reason for their success. They also took a stand politically in support of trading land for peace. And this goes back to the late 70s. Right? In 1977, 1978, Israel is negotiating peace with the Egyptians. And the question is, do we give back the land in the Sinai that had been conquered previously? And the position of the Shas party was to support this trade of land for peace. And Rabbi Ovadia justified it not as party politics, as we will get into the government that's in power if we will be willing to go along with this, but he actually justified it as halakha, as Jewish law. Sorry, there was a question? Okay. He justified it as a matter of Jewish law. His contention was, the contention of Rabbi Yosef was that number one, when it comes to a decision like this, when it comes to a decision about trading land for peace, it's important that you ask the generals. You ask the people who will know whether this is a safe thing to do or not. And if it will save lives to make this exchange, if it will lead to a treaty, then we're going to go along with it and we're going to join a government that's willing to do it. And that was what led to the falling out with Rabbi Shach in the early 90s. Because when Rabin's government was looking towards Oslo and making a peace agreement, they needed support in order to maintain their coalition. And Shas went in with the coalition. And Rabbi Shach was aghast at them for doing it, but that was Rabbi Yosef's position, was to join the Rabin government. And so that was when they had their split. But they actually supported the Rabin government and Oslo. They only walked away from the land for peace concept with disengagement in 2005. At that point, they said, enough. And the rationale for it was simply to say, this is not a military decision being made anymore. This is a political decision that's being made. This will not bring anybody safety. And therefore, they couldn't justify it. And they actually stepped away from the government at that point, from Sharon's government. Shas has had problems over the years. The primary problem, Aryeh Deri. He's the one who's the face of the problem, put it that way. Aryeh Deri was a young fellow who Rabbi Ovadia Yosef took under his wing and made a leader within Shas, but he was arrested and indeed served jail time for various issues involving the money that he took and the decisions that he made. I don't remember the specific charges anymore, whether it was bribery or fraud or laundering or whatever it was, but there were people who came up within the party who used their positions within the party to support the causes that they wished to support, or in some cases to support themselves. So this unfortunately is what happens when people get involved in power positions. And that was one problem that the Shas party had. It never touched Rabbi Yosef. There were never any allegations about him doing this, but the leaders within the party that he founded and led were. And then the other issue that he dealt with, or that he didn't deal with, I should say, really, was the problem that his language brought upon himself and upon the people he represented. We mentioned last week that he was a populist. When he spoke, he knew what would bring people back time and again to hear him. And he also knew that he had a lot of enemies. He had people who did not like the power that he wielded. There were people who did not like the legal positions that he took. And they were looking to pick apart the things that he said and to find something that would offend people. And he went from an era in which you spoke in a room to however many people, and those are the people who heard you, and you knew who was there, to an era in which you could be recorded, to an era in which he was speaking broadcast live by satellite. He would give speeches on Saturday nights that had audiences of tens of thousands of people around the world. And when you do that, if you don't stop and watch your words, you know what's going to happen. And he knew exactly what happened because it was in the headlines the next day, where they would hear things that he said, which were incendiary, statements that were made about groups whose positions he didn't like, or sometimes people he didn't like. And those were, if you go back to what we said, it's not on the sheet this week, but if you look back at the sheet last week and you saw what Yossi Sarid had to say, granted that the things that he excerpted were taken out of context, ultimately statements about victims of the Holocaust, that there were sins that led to the Holocaust, statements about global disasters and it's a punishment for X, he made statements in a way that he knew would attract crowds and get people to listen. And when he was asked, but you know that you know what you're leading to when you do this, he said, yes, but tens of thousands of people are listening to these lectures, and he felt it was worthwhile. There were some who contended that there was an element of dementia in his last years, and that led to the loss of the inhibition. But I have to tell you, I mean, if that was dementia, given the fact that at the same time he's giving hours-long lectures that are not, I mean, these are coherent, well-sourced, and so on. He's writing responsa, the likes of which, you know, nobody else is able to, citing. I wanted to actually bring, and then I ran out of time. I might do it next week. What I was going to do was bring a random responsa of his. In the Hebrew, obviously, I'm not going to sit down and translate, you know, a dozen pages, but just put in bold the books, the names of the books where he quotes them, just so that you can see how many texts there are that he's bringing to bear on every issue in thousands of responsa. It's just, it's mind-boggling. So if this was dementia, I don't know. It didn't look like it. It didn't look like anything that I've ever seen before, that's for sure. Brenda?
One of the problems against pluralistic religion in Israel.
I don't think they're influential enough anymore to say that they would be part of let me put it differently. They're certainly not pluralistic. Without a doubt, their Shas's position is not pluralistic. Would they go along with respectful compromise? I'm not sure, but they don't have enough seats in the Knesset at this point to be the ones who would swing the vote. They might be in the coalition, but they don't hold the power. At one point, they had something like 17 seats or 19 seats in the 120-seat Knesset. You know, large enough that you can swing a major block. They're not there anymore. I don't remember anymore what their vote count is, but you're talking low single digits now.
And did they allow their boys to go into the IDF?
Yes. Yeah. Sorry, there was a hand over here. Yeah. Gloria.
Just interested about the Holocaust. How can you say that? I know a lot of people come to me and they say that, and we identify them. There's so many people that came with the Holocaust survivors.
Right. So I would want to go back to the place in which he said it and see it in context, which honestly I haven't looked up. So I don't know where he was going and what he was doing when he said it. So I can't speak to it right now. It might be something I'll go back to in the email, I think. But it's probably worthwhile to have the email follow up on it. So that's another pitch for anyone who didn't yet register. Make sure you register so you find out about this in the email. Elaine.
I don't know if this is too much of a plunging week, but do you think his comments perhaps were grounded in the fact that he was talking about the Ashkenazi community?
Right. So one wonders if there's a lack of sense. I wouldn't say because he's talking about them, but I think there's a lack of sensitivity.
You know, they were German and, you know, Eastern European Jews who were, not that the Sephardic Jews weren't affected too, but it was different.
Right. No, that's certainly, it's true that the Ashkenazim are certainly the ones who bear the brunt of it, but I don't think he was an Ashkenaz versus Sephard. It might have been a lack of sensitivity. It's entirely possible that he doesn't recognize what this really means, because it's not his part of the world. You know, one shouldn't be shocked by that. You know, the Yizkor practice that we have, right, in our communities originates post-Crusades. That's when it starts. It originates as a response to the Crusades. The communities have their mass grief, their mass mourning, with first the prayer of Av HaRachamim that's instituted in the synagogues, and then that over time, that's actually on Shabbat every week, and then that leads also to Yizkor. There's more to say about Yizkor, but that's basically where it comes from, and that's really an Ashkenazi practice, and then eventually cross-pollination brings it to the Sephardim. But
actually,
the
Sephardi shuls that I'm aware of, they don't do it.
So there are Sephardi shuls that don't. There are Sephardi shuls that do. I mean, I mean, the original Yizkor, I believe, if I remember correctly, was Shavuot. The original Yizkor was Shavuot because that's the time of year when many of the massacres took place. And then it spread from there, Yom Kippur, and then. But there's more to be said about Yizkor. Okay. What I wanted to get back to, though, with Rabbi Yosef, is the principal question which we set out when we did our first series on the chief rabbis, which is, are they rabbis or are they politicians? How do you grasp them? When you create a chief rabbi position in government, you necessarily set up the question of whether he is rabbi or politician. He, on the one hand, the rabbinic position is religious. It's not the same thing as being a prime minister who is also religious, or being a whatever you want, a chief justice who is also religious. The position is religious. It's natural to hold to a religious ideology. That's one way to look at it. On the other hand, the authority of the position is governmental. You are the chief rabbi of the state of Israel, and so you're responsible for everybody. And so the question is, what is a chief rabbi going to do when politics lead one way and Jewish law leads a different way? So we talked about Rabbi Unterman, and we viewed him more as rabbi bound by political considerations. He blends them, but it's rabbit at first. And one of his halachic values was the importance of community. We talked about Rabbi Avram Shapira, who really was rabbi with very slight political considerations. He put the rabbit at first, and sharply so. He was concerned for preserving national unity. He didn't want people to become too zealous, but really he was fundamentally rabbi. What about Rabbi Yosef? So my answer to this question would be that he was rabbi and politician through and through, because to him, politics are halakha. Politics are Jewish law, as far as he was concerned, meaning that Jewish law demands political activity on behalf of the community. There's no contradiction between clergy and politician because they serve the same ends. He was born to be a chief rabbi. Like, that's, to him, was a blending of that which has to be blended. His agenda primarily, restoration of observance of Sephardic halacha, meaning the rulings that of Rabbi Yosef Karo, which we'll talk about shortly, and that dictated certain halachic and political positions that he took. So he believed that he believed in a certain stance regarding how to decide what Jewish law is for Sephardim. So I'll say it now. We're going to come back to it. But I mentioned last week that there were really different groups that are all lumped into the title Sephardic Jewry. There are the Jews who came from Spain and the Jews who came from Italy, Jews who came on the other end in North Africa from Morocco, Jews of Egypt, Jews of Iraq, right? And around the Persian Gulf. You had Jews from various countries, each one of which had their own leading figures, each one of which had their own authorities. So the position that he takes is that Rabbi Yosef Karo, who started out in Turkey and ended up in Tzfat in Israel in the 16th century, and who wrote the Code of Jewish Law, he is the one who every Sephardi has to follow. And all the authorities of Iraqi Jewry, Moroccan Jewry, Spanish Jewry, whatever, are all subsidiary to Rabbi Karo and the positions that he took in the Shulchan Aruch. That was a stance that he felt was very important, and it brought him animosity from other Sephardim, as we're going to see. The Rambam is 400 years earlier than Rabbi Karo, 500 years earlier than Rabbi Karo, and is a heavy influence on Rabbi Karo.
Karo's work is all over. Discrepancy between Rambam and Karo leads to Sephardi.
So let me give a little bit more explanation. The Ashkenazi Sephardi split traces itself back to the period right before the Crusades. As the Jewish community had been before that, going like 6th to 10th century, the Jewish community is led by the Gaonim. The Gaonim are the heads of major academies, which are based in North Africa, as well as what had been Babylon, what is today Iraq. And Jews who had questions in Jewish law wrote letters to the Gaonim and got answers. A lot of the early material in the Cairo Geniza are letters associated with these Gaonim. So there was a community that wrote to one of the Gaonim and said, we don't know what our liturgy should be. Like, what should the prayers be? Because this is way before a printing press. And he sends them back a Siddur. Like, he writes them a text for prayer. That's the earliest Siddur that we have, is Seder Rav Amram Gaon. Rav Amram Gaon sends them, here is their text for what you're supposed to do. There's a Jewish community that asks, you know, we don't really understand quite how Jewish law evolved. We're confused. If it all came from one place, why are there debates? Why is there questions that people ask today? So they send a letter to Rabbi Shrira Gaon, and he writes them back a letter, which is also like a long manuscript, in which he explains and answers that question. Questions, the great and small, are sent to the Gaonim. But what happens is, with the decline of the empire. I'm blanking on the name of the empire now. They're based in Aleppo in that period of time. Not in Aleppo. They're based in Baghdad, excuse me, in that period. And I'm blanking on who it is. But with the downfall of that empire, the Gaonim and their yeshivot, their academies, lose their power as well, and the Jewish community becomes decentralized. You find some who move up in Europe, and then you have others who spread in Africa, and they start to develop their own practices. And then the Crusades come along, and because the Christians and the Muslims are fighting with each other, and the Jews are just trying to, you know, stay out of it to the extent that they can, which unfortunately they couldn't in Europe. But because of the of that, communication is cut off between certain communities. So Jews who are living in North Africa aren't in touch with Jews who are living in Germany. And that's when you start to see the customs differ, and that's when you see different authority. It's really a decentralized type of authority go on during that period of time. Into this situation, you find a work called the Tur. The Tur is written by Rabbi Yaakov Baal HaTurim in the 14th century. And that is a central work of Jewish law, the first major Jewish work of law after Maimonides had done his work in the 12th century. So that work, I don't want to get too technical with it because there's so much that we have to discuss, but that work ultimately leads to Rabbi Karo's work in the Shulchan Aruch, in the Code of Jewish Law in the 16th century. And what Rabbi Karo does is he takes a sort of democratic view of how we decide what the law is when I have multiple authorities. He is Sephardi. He looks at certain key Sephardic figures from Maimonides' time, Rambam's time, in the 12th century, and from the few generations immediately thereafter, and he says, on each issue, if there's a difference of opinion, I'm going to take a vote. Basically, it becomes between three key figures, I believe. It's Rambam, Rashba, Rabbi Shlomo ibn Aderet, and the Rosh, Rabbeinu Asher, whose son was the Tur. And you look at it and say, well, what was the dominant position among them? But Rambam, Maimonides, is a major influence on the Code of Jewish Law. And what Rabbi Yosef is doing in the 20th century is trying to take that and revive that as this is the way we make decisions. And all the people since the 16th century who have been making decisions that run counter to the Code of Jewish Law, he says, if they disagree with Rabbi Karo, they're wrong. We're not gonna follow them. That's the position that he takes. We're going to see more about this in a little bit. But that's a stance that he takes, saying this will unify the Sephardic community. So Jews from Morocco, and Jews from Egypt, and Jews from Iraq, and Jews from Spain are all going to be following this school of thought and this school of law. However, that's not his only position. He believes that halachic positions have to be manageable for the community to follow. That's very important to him. If something is not tenable, if something makes life too difficult, that can't be a position that remains as Jewish law. It's simply not so. It has to be manageable for the community to follow. He believed that politics, political positions, have to strengthen the unity of the Sephardic community and have to empower the Sephardic community to meet its physical needs as well as its religious needs. But everything has to serve that goal. So let's look at how this plays out in practice. First of all, the decision that Rabbi Yosef Karo is the one we have to follow. If you take a look on your sheet, it's source number 3. I translated sections from some of his responsa to try to convey some of his ideas. We're not going to read through all of this. But he writes in this responsum, it is known that in all matters of prohibition and permission, we have accepted the ruling of our master, the Shulchan Aruch, our great master, Rabbi Yosef Karo, whom the King of Kings of Kings wishes to honor. There's a story behind that phrase, but it's not important for right now. As per the great later authorities, among them Maharanach, who wrote the Beit Yosef, that's another name for Rabbi Karo, it's the name of one of his books, has already been accepted upon us as master in our communities to follow his rulings. And Parach Matei Aharon wrote, we have already accepted the rulings of the great master Rabbi Yosef Karo in all of our communities, and especially regarding the laws of prohibition and permission, meaning whether to be lenient or to be strict. And then he goes on and on and on with source after source. Now, what Rabbi Yosef was doing was novel in two ways. If you've heard of Rabbi Benny Lau, Rabbi Benny Lau wrote his doctorate on Rabbi Yosef and Rabbi Yosef's positions in Jewish law. And he had the approval of Rabbi Yosef for what he published, so it was generally viewed as authoritative. What Rabbi Yosef did was he drew on the concept of Mara Da'atra. Mara Da'atra means master of this place, the authority in this location, which is something we have within Jewish law. The idea that in a particular place, this is the authority and you don't challenge that authority. There are a lot of reasons for that. Unity, respect for the person in charge, there are various reasons for that level of authority. But that idea is an old idea. I brought you a source from the 13th century that talks about how the communities could decide that a rabbi who has passed away is still their Mara Da'atra, is still the authority, and he's the one by whom they're going to run all their questions. So he does that with Rabbi Caro. But where Rabbi Shlomo Ibn Adarit in source number 4 says, if there's a disagreement between the deceased Mara Da'atra and your live rabbi right now, you follow the live one. He said, no, you follow the dead one. He said, you follow Rabbi Caro, because he's more expert than the ones you have now. That's number one. Number two, he expanded the idea of Mara Da'atra because he expanded Atra, he expanded place, saying it isn't just about a city or even a country, but it's across this very broad array of communities that he does this. And again, he's drawing on others who did so. I said Rambam, Rashba, and Rush. It's Rif, Rambam, and Rush. It's actually in source number 5. He quoted Rabbi Chaim Yosef David Azulai. I wrote Yehuda there. Maybe it is Yehuda. Now I'm forgetting whether it's Yehuda or Yosef. I have to look it up. But he quoted this work, which you see here, from 18th century, either Israel or Italy, because he traveled, Rabbi Azulai did. But in source number 5, he says that all of our rulings are going to follow the rule set by Rabbi Caro in his rulings, even though he is in Italy. Or maybe not. Again, I'm not sure where he was when he wrote Shem HaGdolim in source number 5. But the point then that I want to make here is that this is a position that Rabbi Yosef establishes, which draws on precedent, but extends it remarkably, and he does this from a very young age. Take a look at source number 6, by Jeffrey Sachs, an article called The Making of an Iconoclast. Remarkably, Rabbi Ovadia began this battle, meaning the battle that everybody should follow Rabbi Caro's positions, or all Spartans should, at the age of 17, when Rabbi Atiyah, who was the head of his yeshiva, sent him to teach a daily halacha class in a Persian Jewish Jerusalem synagogue based on the popular Ben Ish Chai of the revered Rabbi Yosef Chaim, Rabbi of Baghdad, among the greatest modern poskim of the Sephardic community, acknowledged in the same way the Mishnah Berurah is in the Ashkenazi community. Meaning, Rabbi Yosef is sent to lecture in a community of Iraqi Jews. Iraqi Jews had a leading figure known as the Ben Ish Chai, or Rabbi, as you see here, Rabbi Yosef Chaim of Baghdad. And he was the one they followed in this community. Rabbi Ovadia Yosef goes to lecture in that community. And he tells them, Rabbi Caro is correct. Don't follow the Ben Ish Chai. He's 17 years old. However, he quotes you a biblical verse. Yosef could no longer control himself. That's from the story of Yosef and his brothers. The Ben Ish Chai, because he occasionally rules against Rabbi Caro's Shulchan Aruch, was guilty of being one of those corruptors of the pure Sephardic tradition. The lay people and senior rabbis revolted against young Ovadia's critique of the Ben Ish Chai, but Rabbi Atiyah supported the young teacher whose iconoclasm has grown ever since. He takes a stand, and he has the scholarship to support it. Because he can quote you books until you're just, you know, asleep or you know, hell. And he'll tell you, this is the way it is. And you may not like it, it may not be the way you do things, but this is the way it is. And that's within the Sephardic community. But he also says Sephardim should not follow Ashkenazi laws and Ashkenazi rulings. I mentioned last week, one of the ways in which they tried to unify the Jewish community was regarding Yibum. Yibum, again, is the old practice, which is found in the Chumash, it's found in the Torah, but it even had antecedents before that, that if a man passed away without having any children, then his wife could marry his brother. So the brother-in-law and sister-in-law would be able to get married. If they got married, that was Yibum. They also had the option of Chalitza, in which they would separate. That practice, though, was stopped in Ashkenazi communities ages ago. I mean, they would just do chalitza. They would do the ritual that separates them. They would not do the marriage. And that goes back to a view in the Talmud that says, you know, you're really only supposed to do yibum if it's for altruistic reasons. Meaning, you want to maintain the name of the deceased brother. If it's because he saw her at a family gathering and he fell in love with her, or if it's because there's money in the family in that estate and he wants to take over the estate to help himself, then they really shouldn't do this. It's meant to be something that is altruistic. You take care of her, you maintain the name of the deceased brother. That's what's appropriate to do. And so the Ashkenazi community said, realistically, people aren't so altruistic anymore. And they said, just do the chalitza, do the separation, don't do the yibum. But the Sfaradim kept right on doing it. So, in 1950, the Israeli chief rabbinate, including Rabbi Uziel, who was the Sephardic chief rabbi at the time, said, no more Yibum, even among Sephardim. We're going to unify under the Ashkenazim. In 1951, a case of Yibum comes before Rabbi Yosef in his rabbinical court. And he writes a decision saying, I don't care what they say. We're Sephardim. We're not Ashkenazim. Take a look at number 7, where I gave you a translation of part of the introduction and then part of the conclusion. He says, an account came to us in the local court in Petach Tikva. The sister-in-law of a Yemenite immigrant became eligible for Yibum with him. Now, he was looking for this. You've heard of the term activist judges? He is looking for this, because this is a case where neither the man nor the woman wanted to do Yibum. They wanted to do chalitza. But he takes the opportunity to write a responsum against this rule that's been made. They're not doing yibum anyway. But he's going to be an activist, and he's going to teach you what in general should be the options available to Sephardic families. So he says, I am contemplating the new enactment accepted in Jerusalem by the Israeli chief rabbinate, February 1950, which says, in most Jewish communities and in Ashkenazi communities in Israel, they've accepted as law to follow Rabbi Moshe Isserles, lead Ashkenazi authority from the Code of Jewish Law, who ruled that chalitza precedes yibum, and that even when both the man and woman wish to perform yibum, we do not permit it. This is the proclamation that had been made. Because in our day, it is clear that most men do not intend Yibum altruistically, and for the sake of peace and unity in the state of Israel, lest the Torah be as two Torot, we decree upon all residents of Israel and those who immigrate and settle in Israel from this point forward, prohibiting Yibum for them entirely. They must perform Chalitza. This ban may be lifted only in special circumstances by decision of the expanded chief rabbinate council signed by the two chief rabbis of Israel. And he says this was signed by Rabbi Uziel and Rabbi Herzog, but we, the Sfaradim and communities of the Mizrach and Yemen, have accepted upon ourselves the rulings of our masters, Maimonides, and the author of the Shulchan Aruch, who follow the view of the sages in the Talmud that Yibum precedes Chalitza even in our day, when people do not intend it altruistically. We must clarify, does this agreement have any authority for us or not? And he goes through this very long response, and then in part 9, as part of his conclusion, he says, in the end, all has been heard. In my humble opinion, it appears clear that for us, who hold the hem of the cloak of our master, meaning Rabbi Caro, and all the holy who are with him, the majority of quantity and quality of the great authorities from whose mouths we live, that the mitzvah of Yibum precedes Chalitza even today, and there is no authority to the agreement and the presidents and members of the Israeli chief rabbinate, forget it, he says. This is 1951. He's the rabbi of a court in Petach Tikva. But he's going to take on anybody and everybody. He does not care. He doesn't. This is what is right as far as he is concerned. I brought you another example in number 8, which, again, you have it in front of you to see. There's a practice in Jerusalem. Anyone who's been in Jerusalem for Shabbat has probably heard the siren that goes off to tell people to light candles. So candlelighting time in Jerusalem is 40 minutes before sunset. What's the practice here? 18 minutes before sunset, we have a siren. But generally, people, when you get your synagogue bulletin and it says, or you get your calendar, it says 18 minutes before sunset is candlelighting. They're doing it 40 minutes before. This had been discussed in the generation preceding Rabbi Obadiah Yosef, and Rabbi Yechiel Mechel Tukhachinsky, a leading Ashkenazi rabbi, had said, yeah, this is an ancient practice in Jerusalem. It goes back to, it was attested to by the Sephardic work Havachayim. That's what we do 40 minutes before. And Rabbi Obadiah Yosef is asked by somebody, was this really the Sephardic practice? And boy, it's really hard in the wintertime. 40 minutes before sunset? We really need every minute we can get. And his response is to say, of course not. And this ruling from Kaczynski is wrong. And the quote from the Kafachayim is wrong. And it's not so. And he says, even if somebody follows this practice, thinking that it is the ancient practice, they are allowed to change their practice. They do not need any formal ritual, hatarat nedarim. You know, it was a mistake. He says it's all wrong. They think this was the practice. Sephardim were here in Jerusalem when there were no Ashkenazim around, and we never did this 40-minute practice. That's the position he takes. He talked about it in terms of Sephardic pronunciation in congregations. He says the Sephardic pronunciation is the right one, not the Ashkenazi pronunciation of Hebrew. And he also insists that Torah has to be livable. Even as, and he sounds very severe, but you have to remember, one of his values, and he is severe about this also, is that Torah has to be livable. Example. He was asked a question about a restaurant which wanted to be certified kosher. They had been running as a non-kosher restaurant. They produce meat and milk. They won't cook it together. But if somebody wants to order at his table, he wants to have a hamburger and then be served ice cream, they want to be able to serve that. Can you certify such a restaurant? Take a look at source number 10. I was asked regarding a restaurant where Jews eat, where the owner is ready to accept certification by the local rabbinate so that the restaurant's food will be halachically kosher, and to listen to the instruction of the mashgiach, the supervisor, regarding the kashrut of the food, on condition that the mashgiach ignore those who wish to eat dairy, parentheses ice cream, right after meat, or even to eat them together cold. It's not going to be cooked together, but eat them together. Is it worthwhile to accept this condition to prevent cooking and eating non-kosher food and actual meat and milk mixtures? Meaning if we don't certify this place as kosher, so there'll be McDonald's. They're going to be outright non-kosher. Or let the wicked do as they will and perish is the response. Too bad, it's not my problem. And he goes through again this very long ruling, and he concludes, in any case, it is clear that since this would be a total rescue of many people, meaning they would now be eating kosher food, certainly it is a sacred duty for the local rabbinate to fence in the gap which they can fence in and to certify the restaurant according to halakha. He rules the restaurant is to be certified knowing what's going to happen. Yeah. Well, it was probably based on this. Okay. So, without commenting on whether this is a good practice now, the point that he's trying to make is that you need to give a ruling in a way that people are able to live with it and to gain whatever you can gain in terms of religious practice. That's his response. As I said before, he was a strong activist in terms of freeing the Agunot from the Yom Kippur War, and not only that, but he was a strong believer in community activism in general to compel a husband to give a get, which is a very controversial issue within Jewish law. And he said you could absolutely have community activism. There are always limits on what one can do, but he was a believer in that level of activism. And there's a story. Take a look at the story in number 12. Number 11 was his rejection of a stringency regarding the laws of Nidah. But take a look at number 12. This is a story that his son, Rabbi David Yosef, told at his funeral. At the funeral, Rav Avadia's son, Rav David, related that after suffering his first heart attack 14 years ago, Rav Avadia needed a stent to be inserted in order to widen his artery. Rav Avadia told his family he wanted to go home, but they explained the surgery was critical for his well-being. He then asked to go home for at least 3 hours in order to take care of an important matter. What matter? He had been dealing with a case involving an aguna before his heart attack. If I don't survive the surgery, who will take care of this case? The poor lady will suffer. Say, he says, delay the stent. Yes, he just had a heart attack, but delay the stent in order to be able to take care of the case. You have to, you know, it's fascinating, and this applies to many, many issues that he discussed. He was the major authority who ruled on Ethiopian Jews, if you remember the discussion last year, who ruled that they were Jewish, enabling their aliyah, right? We had this whole discussion about how the efforts for aliyah for them stopped in the 1950s when Rabbi Herzog said that they're not recognized as Jews. Rabbi Herzog thought he was doing them a favor because it avoided mamzer issues. And then the result is that all the efforts to bring them to Israel come to a halt until Rabbi Ovadia in the 70s says they're Jewish. And at that point, Operation Solomon, Moses, all of that starts again. It's a function of him. He was, on the one hand, admired and beloved, and you see it. We talked about 800,000 people at a funeral in Israel. It's just mind-boggling. More than 10% of the country is there at his funeral. He was admired and beloved on the one hand, and then others rejected and reviled him, whether because of the things that he said in the Saturday night speeches or whether because of his stances that he took politically in terms of land for peace, for example, or in terms of their opposition to his attempts to revive the Sephardic community. Okay, I left 5 minutes for Rabbi Eliyahu. That's not going to work. But we're gonna start with Rabbi Eliyahu now, and then he'll get another 5 minutes in the beginning of next week, and you can't not say anything about Rabbi Mordechai Eliyahu. It's not fair. He was on the flyer, after all. So we'll do something here. First of all, people asked last week about the electoral process, so I found a quick link for an article on selecting a chief rabbi, Israel and elsewhere, in number 13. I gave you the link. So again, those who got the sheets by email will be able to click on that and see an article. We have seen that Rabbi Ovadia was a strong, powerful personality, and that he followed up on being chief rabbi by founding a political party, right? So how do you take over for him? You're the next Sephardic chief rabbi. What do you do? So the answer with Rabbi Eliyahu was, you do it without any apology. Rabbi Eliyahu was a fiery figure, took no prisoners. Very much on the Rabbi Avram Shapira side of the rabbinate, committed to his positions, stopping short only of encouraging actions that would be overtly destructive. But short of that, adamant and fiery. He clashed with Rabbi Ovadia on issues of Jewish law, and he clashed with him on issues of politics as well. Rabbi Ovadia may have been a fan of the whole land for peace thing until it hit disengagement. Rabbi Eliyahu, opposite end of the political spectrum. I gave you a picture here between sources 13 and 14, so you can see what he looked like, at least in his later years. You can probably find younger pictures online. Rabbi Yosef, you can certainly find younger pictures online. But Rabbi Eliyahu, even though he takes over after Ovadia Yosef, is not that young. I mean, he's born in Jerusalem in 1929. His father was actually an Iraqi Jew. His father was a student of the Ben Ish Chai, who I mentioned before, Rabbi Yosef Chaim of Baghdad. So Rabbi Eliyahu's father grew up in Baghdad, and then moved to Israel at the instruction of the Ben Ish Chai, which already tells you something. It tells you he's not going to agree with Rabbi Yosef about following Rabbi Yosef Karo, because he's going to follow the positions that Iraqi Jewry have been following from his father's mentor. So Rav Shapira Rav Eliyahu was born in Jerusalem in 1929. At the age of 11, he lost his father. As a youth, he gets himself in trouble. In 1948, he was involved in attempts to hold the Jewish quarter in Jerusalem in the War of Independence. They did not succeed. But then he becomes involved with a group called Brit HaKanaim. Brit HaKanaim is probably best translated as the Covenant of the Zealots.
The what?
Covenant of the Zealots. Yes. What they wanted to do was to instigate government policies which would align the Jewish state with Jewish law. And their activism included attempts like, well, you'll see some of it when we get to number 14. What time is it? All right, we have time for this. Take a look at number 14. This is an article on the Knesset website. What was the Zealots Alliance? The Zealots Alliance was the name of a radical religious underground that operated in Israel during the years 1950 to 1953. Their goal was to force Jewish religious law on Israeli citizens and to establish a state based on Jewish law. The General Security Service received information that this group was going to cut the electricity and toss a smoke bomb into the Knesset during a Knesset debate on the recruitment of women into the armed forces. On May 26, 1953, two members of the group were apprehended when they were on their way to placing a bomb at the Ministry of Education building in protest over the public school system. Among the Zealots Alliance were included Rabbi Mordechai Eliyahu, later the chief Sephardic rabbi, and M.K. Shlomo Lawrence of Agudat Yisrael, who was later the chairman of the Knesset Finance Committee. He is 21 years old at the time. He is tried and he serves 10 months in jail. Now, what this article on the Knesset website doesn't mention is the scandal that followed the arrests, because they were held in a detention camp and without being given due process and without being given a trial. It was administrative detention, and there were stories that circulated afterwards in the media about the abuse that they underwent at the hands of the Jewish police, leading Menachem Begin to protest on the floor of the Knesset. And that's number 15. But I think what we'll do is we'll pick up with that next week. There's a lot to talk about, obviously, here. So next week we'll start with Rabbi Eliyahu and then continue on to Rav Kook.